We were using a resource book, it's a study guidebook, which I think is helpful for our purposes here, and also maybe helpful if you are interested in doing something like this back in the parish. Earl Brill, who teaches at American University in Washington, D.C., has this particular book, the Future of the American Past. In other words, asking the question, is there anything in our past that will, you know, help us, you know, in the foreseeable future, or has our world changed so much that there's really nothing much from our past that's usable? Can we rely on some of our old traditional ideas any longer? And, for this, and he takes up five or six ideas, and in there, and we're taking up three or four of these in the courses yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The pilgrimage yesterday was the mission. Today we're talking about freedom, and tomorrow on equality. And then he has also one on meeting the mystery of grace. And I would suggest that this would be a useful beginning point for your thinking and reflection, not only here, but as I say, back home again also. And today, I'll have even less discussion, I mean less lecture than yesterday. I'm not running out, it isn't that, but the discussions have been so good and so helpful, at least for me, that I want to get into them as quickly as possible, because I'd rather work from sort of the general, I mean the specific to the general, taking specific case studies, as we'll see, and then trying to frame some idea about what freedom meant and what freedom means and where it might be in the future, because maybe we can be a little bit more optimistic than we were yesterday, because I think we sort of came up rather pessimistic yesterday, that there was so many things that had changed in American life, the work ethic for one, and the idea of mission had changed so much that we were oftentimes, you know, floundering and not really knowing where to go next, because so many of the things that seemed to be right about America and good and, you know, gave us direction and purpose and meaning, such as the mission of America to the rest of the world, have backfired rather badly in certain cases. And even though, hence, there's a question about, you know, where we should go. Let me just very briefly say a couple of things, because I want to try to make the connection between the idea of certain, you know, important values in American life, such as mission that we've been talking about, and today on freedom and tomorrow on equality, and you know, religious faith, because the question always becomes, do we need a, you know, a religious perspective in order to protect and advance the values and the convictions that we believe important in American life? I don't think we can say any longer that we are a, quote, Christian nation, because of the idea of religious pluralism in this country. We tend to lean more on, I think, what we can call the Judeo-Christian tradition rather than on a strictly Christian perspective. With this, but even then, even now, obviously, the statistics are showing that there is a gradual decline, again, in church membership, a gradual decline in attendance, a gradual decline in stewardship, and general interest, and that the Christians in this country may well be a minority in terms of population in a short period of time. And if so, does this mean that we have to have a new set of values which don't rest on what we would call the ideals of the Christian faith about the worth and dignity of the individual, the protection of certain, you know, what Jefferson called inalienable rights? Do we have to rethink these since we're moving towards, you know, greater mass society with more government involvement all the time? Does this mean an inevitable, you know, diminishment of individual rights, which we like to think are God-given, coming to us from the very beginning, going back to the Puritans and to the founders of the country? Or are we able to find from, you know, our past values and directions which will see us through some of the very difficult questions and problems which we face today with this? And one of these very significant values which Brill talks about and which I would like to raise for discussion is the idea of freedom. And I don't want to start off with a textbook definition, because I think if we went around, we'd probably have as many definitions, you know, as there are people. And we spend all our time on definitions, and if any of you have ever been in a discussion group, we never get off the ground after definitions, you know, because you can't agree on definitions, and, you know, I think it's kind of a waste of time. So maybe by the end of the period, after discussing things, we can come to some agreement on what freedom means in this country. And I would like to, you know, sort of plunge in with that. Oh, I thought Paul wanted to speak already. I'm sure we'll hear from him before too long. Oh, the door shut. All right, fine. Good. With this. Now, the idea of freedom, of course, is something which is, you know, very basic to the whole Christian faith. I want to read here as some of the things that Paul wrote to the Galatians. For you were called to freedom, brethren, only not to use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love be servants of one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And looking, you know, at our past, if there is a usable past, if the American past has a future, certainly the idea of the search for freedom and all of its, you know, implications and all of its manifestations has been basic, you know, to American life. The first settlers who came to this country, who stayed on in a permanent sense, were the Pilgrims, and then later the Puritans, who were trying to find freedom from the oppression of the Anglican Church in the 1620s, the 1610s, and the 1620s in Britain. And the United States became a haven for all sorts of religious groups who were seeking religious freedom from oppression back in the mother country. For instance, the French Huguenots, they were the Protestants, and they were being severely persecuted by the Catholics under Louis the 14th. Right, and the French made a terrible mistake there, because the Huguenots were some of their most highly skilled and superb craftsmen. The Revere family would be a very good example of this, and we all know Revere were in metallurgy, and the Revere family goes all the way back to be great coppersmiths. And but because of religious persecution, Louis drove these artisans out, and many of them came to this country. Dunkers, you know, Anabaptists, Baptists themselves, Jews came. We had congregations as early as the 1643, if I'm not mistaken, in Rhode Island. The idea of freedom from, many times, this lasted, of course. I'm sure many of our ancestors came over in the 1850s and the 60s and the 70s, either from Germany or from Scandinavia. Interestingly enough, there in the idea of freedom, and it was always amusing to me when there was so much hubbub about, fleeing to Canada to avoid the draft, I'm sure many of the people who protested about the draft evaders had ancestors who couldn't wait to get out of Bismarck's Germany to get over here, because otherwise they'd have to serve in Bismarck's army. And what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, I suppose you could say, with that. But the idea of, you know, religious freedom has been, of course, one of tremendous importance in American life, and one which is still very much, you know, a live issue today. And we can talk about this with certain decisions on church and state, and I think that'll be helpful. A second area of freedom, obviously, has always been that of economic freedom. And this has been, you know, pretty much what we call the American dream, that if you come to this country, you obey the laws, you work hard, you save, you invest, you get involved in building community, that you're entitled to a better, you know, standard of living, a better income than you had before. And it is yours simply because these resources are made available to us, and that by developing the land and the resources, you are obviously serving the best interests of the community. And, you know, the success stories in America, from rags to riches, the Horatio Alger thing and all the rest, are, you know, unlimited in number. And they've always served as an inspiration. There's always, you know, the idea that there's room for one more good one, you know, at the top, that as long as you follow the rules, that you too can succeed. The idea of economic freedom, unhindered obviously by government regulation or by church regulation, whatever it might be. And the third area of freedom that's always been so important for us and still is, you know, a crucial issue today, is the whole realm of political freedom. Sometimes, obviously, these aren't separated out, but just for terms of analysis here, for purposes of analysis, I think we have to do this sort of thing, because not only has there been the quest for religious and economic freedom, but also for political, because we've had the idea that, you know, and it's oftentimes been severely tested, that given enough freedom, given enough sense of responsibility, that individuals working through voluntary communities and groups have been able to govern themselves politically. This was the first time really in all of, you know, Western European history that this idea was actually, you know, attempted. This is the great experiment, as it was called. The United States had the first successful, you know, anti-imperialist, anti-colonial revolution, with the idea being that they were capable of governing themselves, even though they didn't have a great deal, many of them didn't have a great deal of formal education, and it wasn't, and nor did they belong to the right church in England, if I'm not mistaken, until the late 1880s. You had to be an Anglican, and you had to be a graduate of either Oxford or Cambridge before you could serve in the Houses of in the House of Commons. So that sort of cut down the limited the number of candidates rather quickly. But in America, from the very beginning, there was much more enthusiasm and confidence that individuals could learn to govern themselves on a voluntary basis and be freed from the oppression of taxes and regulations, which had been so burdensome in Europe for such a long time, and which lasted for such a long time in this country. Just one example of this, I remember I did a research paper on The Ole Rolog's novel, Giants in the Earth, and as to especially, you know, motivation for people coming here. And I found that in the 1850s, 4% of the population in Norway owned 96% of the land. And the rest of the land, I guess, was, you know, snow-capped mountaintops or something that really wasn't worth, you know, bothering them. But when 4% of the population owns 96% of the land, you begin to see that there isn't much opportunity for, you know, not much chance for economic opportunity or for, you know, political, you know, involvement, because it was all in the hands of the very wealthy and the very powerful. And this is true in some countries even today, such as Spain and others, which we could mention. All right. So we've always believed in this country that freedom, economic, political, religious, is ours because, you know, of our birthright. As American citizens, it isn't that the government is doing us a favor by giving us these kinds of freedoms, it's that we are entitled to it, and we've had the idea, and it's fallen down obviously many times, that since the people are sovereign, or the people are the ones who have control, then we only give a limited amount of power to the government in order to, you know, protect individual rights and individual freedom as much as possible. And this has always been the tension. How much power is necessary to give to the governors? And, you know, James Madison's question 200 years ago is just as valid today as it was then. Who governs the governors? And as we found out, it sometimes it can be a very scary situation. So the problem with freedom is one which is seen, I think, best as the need for order and stability and certain services being carried out by people in specialists such as government, because individuals can no longer do this themselves. We can't build our own roads, for instance. We can't all be policemen, we can't all be firemen, and all these things. On the one hand, we need this, and on the other hand, there is always the very real question of government itself being, how should I say this, separated from its sources of power, so that it tends to think of itself as an institution above and beyond the control and the regulation, you know, of the people from where it gets its power. And I think here is where the some of the real issues with, you know, the question for freedom arise today. Okay, now what I want to do is ask you for your ideas on where do you see infringements, you know, specific case examples, where do you see infringements on your freedoms taking place in America right now, which you don't think are fair, or which you don't think are or which you not only don't like. I mean, none of us, I think, like to pay a lot of taxes, but I think we all agree that some taxes are necessary. Somebody has to pay the police force and so on. But one specific example, where do you see infringements? And then I would like to get a list from all of you, and we can talk about these and see if we can come to some conclusions as to where we stand in terms of the possible future of the whole idea of political or economic or religious freedom, you know, in our country today. Where would you start? Would you start with taxes? That's a good specific one that I think we're all here over 18 and we all pay taxes. So it's something that involves all of us. I remember the first time I got my first paycheck and who's this guy Fika? I was paying all that money to. I just didn't know what that was all about. And I sure thought that was, you know, that guy or whoever agency or whatever was sure getting a lot. That's Social Security, obviously. But anyway.
I think one of the frustrations there is more direct say-so in-house where that money gets spent. Not that I object so much to the amount I pay, but from time to time I just would like a little more direct say in how it gets spent. Rather than just through that congressman I vote for, who then has to make a decision in concert with another 535 legislators, and then the bureaucracy. I see the bureaucracy determining much more how money gets spent than how my elective representative says, and in turn myself, as far as taxes. It's not the amount, but from time to time, I just really wonder how a lot of it gets spent.
You just don't yell loud enough then, probably. I think we have an awful lot of apathy, don't you think? I mean, we've been too willing to let our lobbyists go ahead and lobby, unless we have Because one very radical can make an awful big splash in a puddle.
Somebody who's well organized and has a lot of information. Do you think, in a sense, a power vacuum has set in here that by default, we haven't, as you're suggesting, we haven't kept careful or close enough tabs on those who represent us, not only our congressmen and senators, but other government officials, and as a result, they really don't necessarily feel responsible to, you know, explain everything that's...
Well, I think, too, you know, it's that they come up with a budget, and then you have these vast sums of money, like he said, and they kind of disappear totally into the, you know, into these maws. But, you know, every once in a while, something comes out, they're building an airplane worth, you know, $150 million, and do they need it or don't they need it, you know? And we really don't have anything to say about, you know, this kind of thing. It seems that within the chain of the military bureaucracy and the regular bureaucracy, this is all already predetermined. It's like, you know, it's like in the Department of Agriculture, just, you know, tells the farmer how many, you know, fields, how much wheat he can grow, or how much milk he can sell, what he sells it for. For most of us, it's just the case that you got this huge thing, and you just don't know where to go.
Is it, do you think, a lack of information that bothers us?
It's the way it's set up. You know, now, in response to this, in making splashes, the splashes I don't seem doing that much good. So often, what we get frustrated over is a specific thing that is over with before an organization can really develop to make a big enough sound to counteract the other side. And then if you build an ongoing thing, this is basic, I see Gardner's concept in Common Cause, you build in all kinds of prejudices there that I may not agree with. I may agree with John Gardner's concepts of getting a voice, but it's not my voice. And what Common Cause has turned out to be is a very much intellectual, liberal, group that has a point of view, but he's not necessarily speaking for me or speaking for very many Americans, really. Mm-hmm. But he's got, you know, he's going to reflect where most of his support comes from. And so this, you know, it's really hard to fight, you know, and I don't know, you know, people, the federal government payroll now is what, millions. Military alone is 2+ million. And then you start talking about another couple, 3 million in the other agencies.
The government is the largest single employer from the standpoint of employing people in the country.
And this is where the money comes through. We don't see the legislature saying we need to spend money in this area. We see the Department of Defense, this is where we need to spend money. And then what the point of squabble usually is how much is spent, not where it's spent so often. Most of the programs are coming out of the bureaucracy. They're not coming out of the legislature. And this is our fault and the legislator's fault for allowing them to develop into that.
Well, it's that they can, the bureaucracy or the executive department, I guess you might call it, can willy-nilly, you know, start something going, or else what's even worse, too, a lot of time now, they, you know, cut off funds, you know. Just say, well, we don't want to give some money to the poverty-stricken anymore. It's gone, you know. Not even Congress itself can stop this kind of thing. They just do it, and by the time Congress gets done dallying around, and it's way too late.
Well, it gets scary. A couple of months ago on the news, you know, well, the Ford people are not too concerned about unemployment as far as the election coming up. They're much more concerned about the economy and the 80% of the people that see the economy growing than the 10 to 20% of people, whichever ratio happen to be, that are unemployed. Because, you know, you don't need that percentage of the vote, and they're probably not going to get that percentage of the vote anyway. So, you know, when you see that kind of
sense, are we trapped here because we believe, you know, in rule by the majority, but it's so easy to oversimplify and, you know, political issues so far as spending is concerned. So the way in which the money is spent, you're saying, is determined primarily by the desire of the spenders to stay in office?
Yeah.
And of course, lobbyists have so much power here. Again, your oil cartels and your, all of them, even your farm bureaus exert so much influence, you know, that the individual has nothing to say, and the powerful self-interest can really, you know, and in the military, of course, exerts, you know, all they have to do is say, all right, you know, to a senator, your state isn't getting any more money for an engineering product.
Well, look what they did to Massachusetts, because they didn't vote for Nixon, the one state.
Paul?
As I hear these two gentlemen, they're both saying very similar things, they're saying that And in our present governmental structure, the individual voice, the individual's wishes can't be heard. So then I would ask the question, since this is the complaint, what structure do they visualize other than the one we have now so that the individual voice would be heard? What kind of structure would it be?
Well, I think the thing I would say is we've got to quit having the federal government spend so much money and start having state and local government become much more active in developing programs and spending monies.
When you say local, what's a...
City, county, state?
Township.
Okay. Okay.
How do you visualize that the township of Waterville, Minnesota, that's one of the most important townships in Minnesota.
That's right up there with the top three or four, that's right.
The township of Waterville, Minnesota should decide whether or not we should build a $50 billion airplane or a $150 million aircraft carrier. So how should the township of Waterville...
Well, that's not a decision they should make. I wouldn't say they should make that decision.
That should be made at the federal level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see. So then there are a lot of decisions that have to be made at the federal level.
Defenses have to be...
Including the decisions that some complaints were made about. I think the specific objection was, here's a great big airplane going to be built. You don't have anything to say about whether it should be built or not. Well, how are we going to have something to say about it?
Well, there should be some, there should be at least another side here. There should be kind of a watchdog thing about, it's just that the military says, okay, we need this airplane, we're going to build a thing, and that's the end of it. But what we do need is somebody to really look over that thing who has the knowledge but is not involved in the military.
It shouldn't be us then, it should be somebody that we appoint.
Well, not as individuals. What I think of here again is, as individuals, we've got to assume more responsibility what's going on in our country ourselves, rather than just going down, hitting the little buttons on election day. I'm thinking of, in the case of mentally retarded in this country, I guess every state has several colonies of mentally retarded, but you go to Sweden, they don't have a single one because all the mentally retarded are absorbed into the community. But we have advocated this responsibility to take care of these people. I know in Wisconsin they set up huge budgets, built great big things run by bureaucrats to take care of this one. And it's, we don't take our responsibilities. And again, when they had that big earthquake in Iran, and it killed thousands of people, the Shah sent in 12 army units. He's going to pick all the children out and save them. When he got there, didn't find a child. They've been absorbed into the community. See, these people take their responsibilities on this basic level here. This level is where you got to start on personal responsibility.
I think the problem is...
But where are you going to start? I'm just guessing. I'm not an attender of political meetings typically, but I'm wondering how many people in this room have been at a local political meeting in the last year. I haven't been in the last year.
Go ahead.
Good, we've got a pretty political group then. But that would be a small percentage of your population who do attend your local political caucus.
You said something kind of important. He just said the largest employer is the federal government, is the government. And federal civil service employees do not have full political participation.
That's right.
The Hatch Act. They are restricted. They are not fully.
Yeah, the Hatch Act, right. I think it's a good act, isn't it? What I'm getting at is that do we have a sense of sort of a fatalism that we really can't do much about this big, thing like the defense budget, and we aren't experts on, long-range missiles. Although we did, who was the one senator who kept after Secretary McNamara all during the 60s on the TFX? And McNamara just sort of rammed it through, and then it turned out to be one of the greatest boondoggles of all time. I don't know how many millions or billions of dollars of cost overrun they had in a, somebody like that kept after them.
And that was Proxmire.
Was it Proxmire? Yeah. He is always sort of a watchdog, isn't he, about government spending? And
yeah, he kind of.
That's right.
There's a lot in the system that can work. If you just like this, if the Congress, they really get out and, I'm trying to think what bill it was, where they really went out and they listened to the people and if they'll have their hearings go out and if they will listen and if they'll just, break out of that, that thing in Washington, it's become so institutionalized and really assume a leadership role. And I think a lot of this listening can be done.
What I'm suggesting is that maybe the wheels, how should I say this, the power, has become so vast, and the way in which you gain knowledge of control, or for control over it, has become so difficult to understand that a lot of us simply, you know, bow out by default, because it seems as though, you know, you work hard, you get involved, and you push buttons and, you know, ring doorbells and all the rest, and then suddenly, I know I, for instance, and suddenly, you know, it's lost. I'll just give you one small example. I worked very hard for a certain candidate for governor in 1970, and I went to the convention. I got myself elected delegate from Rice County and the whole thing, and went up and worked very hard. And I'm not sour grapes because my man wasn't nominated for the governor, but what happened was that there was a stalemate among five candidates, and the power brokers went out in the, you know, wherever they went, I don't know, it's a smoke-filled room or whatever, but they went out somewhere, and they finally worked out the compromise. And all my doorbell ringing and hard work and everything, you know, went down the drain. And I was, you know, mad. I really was, because...
Who promised you success?
What?
Who promised you
Yeah, I know.
Success?
Sure, you keep fighting, right. Right, absolutely, keep battling and keep fighting, but, it, you know, it was none of this so-called... It was just as though they were trying to keep the, you know, keep the delegates happy by keeping them busy. You know, and if you keep them busy, they aren't, you know, they'll feel like they're really doing something, whereas, you know, the real power is still in the hands of, you know, a small people. And I became kind of cynical for a while about it.
Yeah, political caucuses are not all that democratic because there are so many decisions made elsewhere.
They're handed down.
The local decisions they make.
And then you learn there's this about PR groups like this one in California. What is it, Spencer Roberts?
Oh, yeah.
Where they take on one candidate in any given, you know, campaign. And they've never lost, no matter if it's Republican or Democrat or vegetarian or whatever, they've never lost.
Yeah.
Which makes you think that it's a matter of PR rather than a matter of so-called voter input. I think Thomas Jefferson would turn over in his grave. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get the right image, and maybe some of you saw that, well, you read Joe McGinnis's book, The Selling of a President, 1968, where they sold you know, Nixon like a Buick. The same company, in fact, had the Buick account and Nixon's account. Paul?
This lack of participation by the grassroots is not exactly anything new.
No.
I doubt that the grassroots had very much to do with the picking of General Washington.
Yes, that's... Well, but we're promised this, right? Well, I guess Washington got it because, one, he had some experience, and secondly, he was the one, in case the government couldn't meet the payroll, Washington could personally.
No, and he said yes, too.
No, a certain decision, like military decisions, I don't think can be, you know, can be done on a grassroots basis. Because didn't they in the Civil War, you elected your own officers? I think if you came from a community like Terre Haute or something, you elected your own officers. Well, I've been in the military, and I would have liked to have had a vote on some of the officers. You know.
They worked out.
I had, but, you know, they won, but, you know, it was a big price. But I think other decisions can, and they always promise it. You know, the promise is that, you know, get involved.
It didn't have much to do with the writing of the Declaration of Independence in many aspects.
The grassroots had very little to do with the selection of representatives in the way the Constitution was originally
set. Yeah, but the grassroots were the ones who fought the Revolutionary War, and they were the ones who died there. And they were the ones that made it possible for these guys to go to Philadelphia and write this.
Well,
and it is still always the grassroots who die.
I think a big part of the fact, and say it's not the grassroots, and yet these men were in a sense much closer to the grassroots because they came out of a much more intimate kind of society than we have today.
Intimate, when they couldn't even communicate?
In their community, when they were intimate in their community with their people, as far as the people that they were talking
with
about.
With a very small percentage, with a very small number. Because you didn't know who was 10 miles down the road.
There were a much smaller number of people.
Oh, they communicated then, it just wasn't as fast.
Georgia and New York weren't.
When they wrote these pamphlets, they got over the colonies like nobody's business. When Patrick Henry and all these, John Adams was writing pamphlets, he'd write them up in Boston and boy, and to our, in our way of thinking, sure, stagecoach doesn't go very fast, but they weren't in any hurry those days. I mean, those pamphlets get down to Georgia and Florida in a week or two. They knew all about it. I mean, the intellectuals.
The intellectuals were not the grassroots.
But they were there, but they got to the grassroots.
Yeah, let's leave American History 101 and go into civics.
Let's take out of the military for a moment. It just occurred to me that the grassroots didn't have much to do with the writing of the Augsburg Confession.
That's right.
Or the Nicene Creed.
Right.
But isn't it all, but still, from the grassroots you get it's kind of a pyramid, isn't it, kind of thing in human society always, that somehow you try to get the best at the top to do the lawyer now.
I know that the Nicene Creed and the Augsburg Confession is sort of pushed down on the grassroots from the top, more or less.
There's no question, of course, it was a different world because there was only maybe 2 or 3% of the population which was literate, at that time, at best 5%, which was literate in the different languages, and therefore you couldn't expect any, response from the grassroots because they didn't.
Literate has a broader meaning than reading and writing.
No, I meant reading and writing.
I suggest that in the United States today, only a very small percent of our population are literate in the affairs of the government and the necessities of government.
Yeah.
I know that the Nicene Creed and the Augsburg Confession is sort of pushed down on the grassroots from the top, more or less.
There's no question, of course, it was a different world because there was only maybe 2 or 3% of the population which was literate, at that time, at best 5%, which was literate in the different languages, and therefore you couldn't expect any, response from the grassroots because they didn't.
Literate has a broader meaning than reading and writing.
No, I meant reading and writing.
I suggest that in the United States today, only a very small percent of our population are literate in the affairs of the government and the necessities of government.
Yeah. Al Quiar, my congressman, said if he gets mail on an issue from 2% of his constituents, he considers it a landslide in mail. From 2%, except from Northfield. He always gets lots of mail from Northfield, but the college town in southeastern Minnesota. But other than that, I think that's true. And I'm questioning, why? Is it the sense of fatalism that we have? The government is so big? Maybe the country's too big. Maybe Senator Goldwater in 64 was right. We should saw off the East Coast. And I only think he was half joking, really, because he didn't like those Rockefeller Republicans, you remember, and they still don't. They're going to still try to dump Rocky, next year. And so on. I think they will. But anyway, maybe the country's too big. Is that the problem? We're so big, we don't have control. We have the we've decided we're not going to enlarge the size of either House of Congress, and therefore we determine representation on the basis every year
what's,
congressman
what's
gets more.
What's the difference
more.
Now? Guy's got about 250,000. Now, what did they have in, say, 1800? Do you have any idea?
Oh, the total voting population, namely white males, which cuts it down in a hurry, adult white males cuts it down in a hurry, would be, I think, around, total adult population, white population, was 4 million at the time of the ratification of the Constitution.
Did they also have to pay a poll tax?
Yeah.
A lot of them did, right?
Property. You had to own property to be
it
able
wasn't,
to vote.
Yeah. Well, some states, there were 4 or 5, Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, and some that had total white male suffrage, but it wasn't until the 1820s that every state got it, and then it lasted until then they got poll tax, but that's, the racist thing.
But the man represented many fewer people.
But we've decided now the worst thing to do is to add to the number of congressmen, even though there are more people, and I think that's true. The whole thrust, of political scientists is towards streamlining and cutting down on the size of housemaking bodies, of lawmaking bodies. There's an attendance, an attempt, for instance, in Minnesota to eliminate one house altogether because it gets to be too much of a stalemate. And you get to be clubby and loyal towards your house and you defend the house just because it's a house rather than because it's, in the interest of the people. And then the argument that the congressmen come back with is that means they have to take on additional committee work themselves, and they can't do good work, you know, in committee, because if there are fewer representatives, you've got to pass the, you know, the committee work around, and that's where the real, you know, work is done. You have to pass the committee work around, and that means you're overworked. And people are always getting excited every time the legislature votes themselves a $500 raise. That's a surefire, you know, red flag for people. But they vote themselves a raise because they have to spend that much time away from their law practice or whatever other business, and therefore, I think they're entitled to it. I really do. But, you know, from, you know, the stink in Minnesota about trying to get a couple $1,000s more, and I think it's ridiculous because we lost a lot of good people because they can't afford to stay in government. You know, Dr. John Salkirk would be a very good example. He's the one MD, first great legislator, and he also knew, you know, the whole medical field, and he was losing so much money, you know, going down to St. Paul that he had to give up his practice.
And he was making that back in his nursing home.
Well, that didn't come out until, yeah.
Nursing home ripoff. He and Flatney have got something going that you would believe.
Yeah, well.
That's why the legislature, somebody's got it on him. He took the attorney general post so that he wouldn't get prosecuted.
Well, yeah. Oh, I don't want to get into it. We always like to think, you know, all these people out of Minnesota, they saw that picture of Wendy on the cover of Time, you know, holding up the Walleye Pike, and let's let them think that's the way things really are, you know? You know, because nice, clean state, you know, with none of this kind of hanky-panky that goes on. Okay, anyway, are we too big? Is that the problem in America? We're too big?
I don't know how you're going to do it, but we've got to figure out who's serving who. You know, our modern litany is the government will give, you know.
Look how the definition of federalism has changed from the original to the way a state is viewed now in context of the Union to where it was 150 years ago or 200 years ago.
Because no matter what, I mean, with revenue sharing and all the other proposals, the power is still flowing more and more towards, you know, Washington.
Well, revenue sharing, I think, is a shift in the right direction,
yeah.
As far as it's But I don't care if the federal government collects the money as long as the state spends it. I'd much rather have that going on.
Yeah, but look at what happened when revenue sharing. You know, it's supposed to come
in our area, it's going real well.
Most of the communities you got have used it for some really dumb things. It didn't help.
Well, that might be
smarter.
But at least, it's my fault.
In terms of freedom, the argument is that you should be able to have the freedom to make mistakes.
Right.
I mean, they're going through quite a process in the county I live in, the cities in that county, as far as how that money should be spent, a lot of community hearings and decision-making. So I think it can be done well.
And our communities have really caused a great deal of interest, this money coming in, and I think we had more citizen participation,
yeah.
You know, and really more concern about this money coming back, you know, than really all the money going out, you know. And the return on property taxes coming back, and really, I was quite amazed at the meeting, boy, we fill up the auditorium,
yeah.
On how this money should be spent. They were really deeply concerned about it.
To stay with our point on taxes, just want to finish up, I think we can get people involved on the matter of protecting their freedoms, because one sure way to get a large turnout is when they propose an increase, you know, in the real estate tax. And you remember the stink in the Northfield High School, they still haven't recovered over that, you know. So if you tax people, you know, at the most important level, namely the level, you know, of their income, I mean, not tax, but, you know, this is where the government and the citizenry, you know, meet on what should be done, and you give them the sense that we do have, I think, in many states and many local districts, that they can do something about education. That seems to be something that still is, you know, sort of in our control. Then I think, you know, it can work, because in many small communities, the school district is the last place where it seems as though, at least on the surface, there's a great deal of local autonomy over, you know, what can be done, especially in terms of raising taxes for an increase in the kind of program that they have. And that might be a kind of model. But granted, Paul's point that there are some things that have to be done on the national level, or if you like.
But even that school district's getting sucked up more and more,
yeah,
by the federal involvement, the federal ears. Boy, you go fill out Title II or Title IV forms. Just to get a little money.
You were going to say something before I butted in.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in on this tension between revenue sharing, federal government sending the money back to the local situation. There, I even feel a lack of freedom, even though the money does come back to be spent in the local community, and we're given the words that you kind of decide how it's going to be used, yet the federal forms and the federal guidelines are dictating to a large degree some very minute sorts of details that affect programming in the neighborhood where I'm working.
Yeah.
And I guess I feel a lack of freedom at that point when it comes to this penny levy.
Okay, Paul?
I'd just like to throw one little thing into the pot.
You usually do.
Tell a children's story. Every now and then you hear some radical political theoretician suggest that we will obtain grassroots representation by adopting the decimal system, that is, 10 local people gather together and select one out of their 10 to be their man to represent them in the next 10 above, and so forth and so on, all up to the top. We kept chewing that act one for kids.
Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I have no feelings about it. I'm perfectly in
the I thought you were going to tell us the children's story.
Oh, you're going to tell the children.
You've got it both ways. He leaves us with a whopper like that and then walks out. Doesn't have to take all the flack that comes with it. Is this? You think the real threat to the freedom here is the increased government bureaucracy and the increased amount of taxes that it takes from us?
I think that's part of it, but I think that it's a kind of a self-feeding thing. The government does that. Mm-hmm. We make more demands on the government, we being generally people, not you and I necessarily, and give us, no, I said necessarily.
Yeah. Okay.
And yet we hand over to the government more of our responsibilities, and in turn we sit here and feel sorry for ourselves because we have less control.
Yeah.
And so then we become apathetic and cynical. It doesn't matter what we do because it won't have any effect anyway, so we do less and less. You've got a big snowball thing here, and I think taking some artificial formula like this decimal business doesn't solve the basic problem if you do not have an individual commitment among people in a democracy to do whatever they can to be informed, yeah, to be involved, to be responsible.
I think the real threat is we become so security-minded that if the government can promise us, security and protection and all the rest, we really aren't much concerned with, kind of personal freedoms. And this goes right back, I suppose, to the days of the Depression, that more people would be willing to give up certain kinds of personal freedoms if they were, assured of a job and protection of the home or the mortgage or whatever with this. And there is a real lack of commitment to certain personal freedoms. There's always, to give you one example, there's always the experiment that political science classes do. They take a copy of the Declaration of Independence and they go down on a shopping mall, wherever it might be or whatever, and ask people to sign it. And invariably the percentage that say no are 65, 70, 75% of the people who say it's too radical. And I always like the bumper sticker, it's your Declaration of Independence, use it. And what Brill is suggesting is that maybe we've become so complex, maybe the demands for, keeping up on armament and all the rest are so huge, and government spending for, developing new sources of energy, who else can afford it? And all the other things, roads and all the other things are so huge, just keeping up with the demands we place on the government for services, that we aren't able to rely on, we're going to have to sacrifice more and more of our personal freedoms in order to survive.
Either that or withdraw some of our demands or back off from it.
Oh, yeah.
Be willing to settle for less. You
right.
can't have it both
right,
ways.
Right. And lower the standard of living and not have such good highways, for instance. Would we be willing to do that? We can't dismantle what we've got. But in a way, that's sort of happening in some places. I don't know where, all through the country, but about 10 years ago, everybody wanted interstates. And tremendous demand now. In Minneapolis, they can't get that little hitch through Hiawatha Park, because people have backed off from this, and they begin to see what interstates have done to damage and sometimes to destroy.
Okay, you're shifting priorities.
Right, whole communities.
It's the people who have to shift the priorities. Yeah. And if the government doesn't have the priorities that we as individuals want the government to be acting on, then we're the ones who have to tell them so. And if enough of us tell them so, sooner or later, it has to have some effect.
Oh yeah, I think this is the interesting thing. And how do you get the public aroused on certain issues? How do you get them stirred up? For instance, some of you remember the SST thing 2-3 years ago, and there was a case where there was enough government, public pressure, so that the Nixon administration backed off SST and the Concorde, you remember, and buying these super jets that could fly us to London. I'd like to go to London in 3 hours. I really would, for $75 or something, wasn't it? Some fantastic thing they were talking about. And that would be great, but it, you know, there were, you'd have to pay an enormous price in terms of, you know, pollution. And so they did back off. And, you know, you can mention all kinds of other, well, some of the scandals too, but there is where priorities did pay, but it's so difficult to get the public aroused. And you can't keep the public, you know, in constant state of agitation all the time. I begin to wonder whether or not our problem is that we shouldn't have the British system, where if there's a major issue, like, say, Vietnam or, say, Watergate, you don't have to wait 2 years, you know, to turn the rascals out. You can have an instant, well, 5 weeks, isn't it? I guess it takes in England to call an election. And you can turn them out. In fact, that was one of Nixon's objections. And he made, I think, a good theoretical point about impeachment of the president. If you have every president subject to impeachment all the time, you're going to have a British parliamentary system of government where the president can't serve out his 4 years and do his thing. Maybe that's our problem, but it's a structural problem. That our, you know, because, I'll just finish this. John Adams and the others were so convinced on the basis of, you know, the fear of things like the French Revolution, which moved very quickly, that, you know, all society was changed so quickly, that they deliberately put in all kinds of booby traps and monkey wrenches and slow down procedures, you know, in Congress, so that we wouldn't move too quickly. And, you know, in those days, as somebody said, they didn't, you know, they had much more time than we have now. Mm-hmm. But today we've got something like pollution or whatever it might be coming along, and we need, you know, much more rapid action. You know, President Ford was chiding Congress for not having an energy bill because there's, you know, the energy crisis and so on. Maybe that's the problem. It's a structural one.
Nobody ever said democracy was efficient.
No, that's, what is it, Churchill's famous quotation?
Yeah.
It's the best, the worst possible form of government that's ever been conceived except for all the others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But again, it's priorities. Are we willing to sacrifice a democratic way of life in order to have efficiency?
Yeah, right.
I don't believe that Americans are. I certainly am not.
A lot of, I think, my I just threw out, I think maybe many of them are.
That's Maximum and Machiavelli.
Yeah.
Basic.
Or you get into, yeah, I don't want to start playing academic games. Yeah. You've been trying here for about 5 minutes.
I think really one freedom I think we really should have from all government is the right to know. Because they're not, well, in a lot of cases we found out they are holding secrets and they are doing things purposely on secret to keep it away from us. And others are kind of doing it by default, by not giving out information.
Yeah.
See, and when you found, the SST got a lot of publicity because somebody found out about it.
Yeah.
You know? And this, of course, here you got a big reaction. And I think a government responsibility is to keep the people informed, and I'm not really all that concerned about our national security, because right now we got as many bombs as they have, as many submarines. So
I think you're absolutely right. The right to know, the absolute right to know what's going on.
Don't do anything about it.
And in a way, it's sort of insulting, because the idea, no matter which party is in office, that the people really can't stand to know all the information.
That's
if they panic or something, if we knew everything.
Well, that was the big song during the Vietnamese thing.
Yeah, right.
The president knows, let him do. He knows what's going on. And then
I
found out he didn't even know the whole bunch of it. And I think get the military, get them out of this terrible fear they have and get this stuff out in the open. I think we're going to be just as safe.
Yeah.
Even if the Russians know everything about us or any other enemies we may have,
yeah.
I think we're going to be just as safe because they're not insane either, you know. So we have a right to know where the money is going. And if we wish to do something about it, we can. I think you get a much greater response from people if they know, if they have, you know, put it all together. They'll give you, the government will give you information, but it's kind of shotgun effect, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, and you got to be a doctor or something or other to put it together.
They're trying to protect us from reality, and really what we want to say is, hey man, we live in reality too. You're unreal.
Well, this is the
George
Big Brother kind of thing.
I'm going to plug in and say, in going through this, to jog the whole thing away from the money thing, that another area that really is graphic to me is the services we get then from government out of the bureaucracy, out of the institutions that we've set up to serve us is very often poor. From the IRS, I've gone through a couple of things with them, and each institute, not with myself, but with parents.
Yeah, you deal with the IRS back there as a legal secretary, right?
And they're hearing, over a tax bill of $80, and we were questioning, he said that it was a tuition rather than a contribution, and I had one of my parents in there, and I was trying to help them understand how our little school functions, and that it wasn't a tuition. But, if you don't like this, then you go 200 miles to the judge, to the hearing judge, and for $80, the guy made $60 a day, it just wasn't worth it to him. The whole postal service problem, and this kind of it's something I really...
Well, one answer might be, you know, higher taxes to get, you know, more efficient equipment, like with the Postal Service, for instance. Better salaries to attract better people, because a lot of times one real reason in sort of the middle level of government is that we just simply have very mediocre or average people who are afraid to make decisions and who hide behind, you know, all kinds of rules. IRS is the best example of this.
Just lists and books of
We all could tell atrocity stories, I'm sure, here of our experiences with IRS or with police or, you know, somewhere along the line. And I'm sure they, you know, they're all true and they all make us very mad. But
the courts today are just atrocious.
Well, there again, one answer would be to be able to have more money. This is what, you know, Chief Justice Berger is trying to do. So we can have more courts, so people can come to justice faster. And there's some people, because they don't have bail, and here's where justice is not colorblind, where justice, you know, does work to the advantage of the wealthy because they can bail out. And while the poor, black, whatever, don't have this, and they might have to languish in jail for a year or whatever. And it's, you know, it isn't, you know, colorblind at all. And that's a very, you know, crucial problem, because it comes down again to funds. And it's a matter of priorities. Are we willing to pay the higher taxes? Boy, this, I'm wondering if we wouldn't be able to if we could see, you know, better service. But you begin to wonder sometimes, really, I don't want to just sound like a griping citizen, about postal service. Because, you know, in Europe, it's the trains would be another example. Why can't we, if any of you have traveled in Europe, you know how superb the trains are, but in Canada. I mean, we don't have to go to Europe, we can go to Canada. And the Canadian, you know, Pacific is fantastic. And, you know, if any of you Glois, you were on Amtrak, weren't you?
Yeah.
And somebody said Amtrak was like taking a train to Buchenwald. that's what we were trying to do.
They're doing better. I rode the train up from the Bay Area.
Well, I guess it depends. I mean, you know, you never know if the air conditioning is going to be on or off. And
yeah.
Nobody cares much. I mean, they don't have a sense of personal responsibility. I think that's the problem with most government officials. It's, you know, putting in their time, and there's no sense of personal identification with the job well done. And, you know, in America, we've always had the idea of taking pride in your work and being identified with it, so that, you know, it would reflect back on you. Yeah.
But that's a contradiction. The efficiency of some European public utilities and public services to our notion here that it's automatically, if it's government sponsored, going to be inefficient and poor. And I just wonder where that. What happens to?
Well, Mussolini made the trains run on time. You bet.
Yeah.
Sure.
Build big highways.
Who? Yes, right. The Autobahn. Right. That's true.
Or there are other things in European, more socialized kinds of societies, you call them, where there's very good services.
Yes.
And our assumption is that automatically, if government gets involved in those services, they would be poor.
Yeah. They don't. It doesn't have to follow, but maybe it's a self. What's a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, I personally get disturbed that we all want, and private industry often wants, government subsidy and backup, whether it's loans to small business or the subsidization of the aircraft industry. But we don't want to pay for that.
Right. And you know, we're talking here about our friends here from Moorhead, and obviously when people have been, you know, flooded and wiped out disaster areas like happened in this area, somebody has to come to their help, and private industry can't do it. There just isn't enough money, you know, from private insurance companies, for instance, or crop insurance is so expensive.
But then we want big government.
Yes, we do.
In other case, we don't want big government, but when it's our need, we want big government.
You know, it's to our benefit, right. And we want it, except we don't want to pay for it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's like, I know somebody said about changing the structure of it. I think what really the problem is in the whole bureaucratic system and our judicial system, we have about an 1875 structure, and no matter how many computers you put in there, it's still going to be an 1875 structure. And if you can figure out some way to streamline it or to, you know, get things moving without losing the humanity necessary to big government, I think that this would probably
that's been tried, you know, for a long time. But I remember after he had after World War II, former President Hoover was, you know, appointed to head of the Hoover Commission to make, you know, streamline government efficiency. And what happens is that you run into such pockets of entrenched bureaucracy that you just can't budge them, and you don't know, it gets lost in red tape, and a lot of people, you know, simply finally give up in frustration over this, because there are certain people in certain areas who are there, and the voters want them there and will keep them there, because in that particular state or whatever, you know, they're meeting certain needs. And, you know, in terms of the whole country.
But even the military, they did have to finally make some, you know, some cutbacks when their budget was not passed. They finally had to get in, you know, of course they played a little bit of games there, but it's a case of making up, really establishing what are we going to do, and if people are going to get hurt. I mean, there's no way you can get out of this, you know, without some people getting hurt someplace, to centralize things or to streamline them or get a structure that will function.
Maybe our problem is that we've become too dependent on the government, you know, to solve the problems.
We have a great big, big commission there from the government, you know, to improve this whole northeastern part of our state. And these guys just go around willy-nilly making decisions, you know, and just saying what everything that's going to happen in this huge district, you know, and they got the money. And if you want, you know, Green Bay wants a downtown place, you know, well, they got the money. Green Bay does what they want.
Before I get too cynical, I want to put in a plug. I had never been in, you know, where there have been forest rangers before, and I must say, here's government in action, and it's remarkably well done out here, really. I'm just amazed on how, you know, intelligent the whole system is here and how helpful they really are. I mean, these people, the rangers, really want to help us, and they're really here, you know, to serve us. They would like to preserve nature, and I'm sure many of them are so, you know, so dedicated here that they just as soon not have anybody around at all, because there's no chance at all of forest fires and pollution and all the rest. But they realize that people are going to be here. The thing to do is to come to terms with it. And I'd just like to put in a plug, you know, for the Wenatchee National Forest right here, because it's really very well done. But again, it's a sense, they have a sense of personal identification with what they're doing, and they take responsibility for it, and they can see, you know, results on the basis of their action, and hence they're think much more highly motivated.
You don't think of them, though, as in terms of being bureaucrats.
No, I know somebody in Washington has to pass.
It's like state police, too, you know. Yeah. You have to take the eye test, and these guys, you go down and take your eye test every 2 years. They're just, you know, really nice. They're really trying to build the image of our state police up here. But these are guys out on the road. Same with postmen. Yeah. The average postman on the beat, he's usually a pretty nice guy. But in someplace back in there, it's...
Well, the system there, you know, is cockeyed, too, because our postman comes to work just about at the end of his route, and he doesn't want to come in before 4 o'clock.
Did you give him coffee then?
What?
Did you give him coffee?
Well, sure, because if he comes in too early, he'll be given more boxes without more pay.
Yeah.
So why should he? You know, he'll pet that dog for 15 minutes, you know, so prevent him coming in before 4 o'clock and talk, and, you know, and he really knows how to drag it out. And, you know, somehow we haven't rewarded people for additional effort.
We do that in private industry too, though.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Very much. We reward mediocrity, and you know, it all settles at the lowest common denominator. The quality control, for instance, in factories is another example. You know, work standards, and in a sense, you're penalized, you know, for working, you know, too much. And I, you know, this hurts. I don't know. Maybe we could get into the whole. I don't want to start the whole thing of labor unions, because I think they're here to stay. For one thing, and politically they're here to stay, if nothing else. George?
There's been some interesting thing, you know, talking about the negative side of the government happening in California with our new young governor, who has been doing a lot of this why, and it's going to be really something to watch as development next year, because just now there's starting to be some opposition organizing to him, but he's done some really interesting things, just cutting through and getting people together and working it out, and some of the pompadours in the state legislature getting a little muscle.
Yeah, what Newsweek called him "Say Nay Politics." That was the label they gave to Governor Brown. Say no.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's just saying why, and he's like the state university and college system is going bad because after 8 years of Reagan, I'm going to get out from under this, and he comes in and says, "Well, why do you want to do that?"
Yeah.
No, why not? You know, not that you see you need to do that. Why do you need to do that? And it's really an interesting kind of.
I suppose maybe just to sum up on this, because I like to, you know, get in line too early, that my kids are coming in, I hope, anyway, that I think, you know, there's no question there's been a real loss of freedom, and in a sense, some of it is beyond our control. Some things like national security, we take a lot of money. We had to spend all that money in World War II and get into debt simply because we had to win, because the alternative, you know, to going into debt and running up the national debt was, you know, unthinkable. And some things just are going to, you know, require a lot of money, and there was always going to be waste and inefficiency in a war. You know, I'm sure we could all tell stories about the enormous waste. I saw them, you know, take half-used Jeeps, for instance, and they just didn't want to carry them back to America, so they just, you know, left them and just walked off without any, you know, care, and a lot of examples like that. But on the other hand, I think there are enough examples that we could find where, when, you know, the government is reminded of, you know, where its power comes from and where to whom it's responsible, I don't think, you know, the situation is totally cynical or hopeless. Yeah, it might well be, but and I'm more afraid of the public relations gimmick than I am, you know, of anything else.
Actually, many of the bureaucrats themselves are as much victims as we are, because they may want to help, you know, these perfectly nice people may want to help you, but somewhere there's a rule back there that says if he helps you, he's going to catch it in the neck. And it's so much that they got so much of this so that the administrator or your bureaucrat is in a defensive position.
Yeah, right. I'll give you one example, and we always believe in hard work and, you know, moving up on the ladder and getting ahead. Well, with the Internal Revenue Service, for instance, if you're putting in a claim for something that's debatable, inevitably the young people in IRS will stamp it no, because that will show their superiors that they're really tough and paying attention to the case and that they aren't just letting things slide, and that means that, you know, they'll move up a little more quickly. It's just like having an incentive ticket, you know, bonus system for giving out tickets. The more tickets you give out, you know, the tougher you are and the better you're doing your job. Well, you know, so they vote no, they keep stamping no. We had a couple of them, and our attorney finally told us that this is simply the system. And if you want to keep fighting it, fine, but they try to discourage you because they make so much red tape that, you know, you figure, what the heck, give up. And some see it through. We gave up. We hit the red tape, and it just looked like, you know, an endless procedure and driving up to St. Paul, you know, and paying an attorney, and, you know, finally, you know, it was only $300 in 1958. That was a lot of money, and we gave up. One else, other teacher saw it through, but it took 3 years. And this, whether you can claim, you know, your doctoral dissertation, the expenses, you know, on your 1040.
Did you get it?
We didn't get it.
You did.
You did.
About 3 years ago.
Yeah. We lost, but we had some little, well, I don't want to say it, tin horn, you know, bureaucrat. But anyway, thanks a lot. Come tomorrow. We'll talk on equality.